Ladies and gentlemen, the last few days have shaken the world so severely that it is difficult for any of us to think entirely logically, not to have our thoughts seriously influenced by our own beliefs and convictions. Where Hendrik Van Loon stands in his struggle between democracy and autocracy can be no secret to any of those who have listened to him these last 3 months. And if there still were any doubts, he will tell you tonight. Hendrik Willem Van Loon.
Well, this evening, I'm going to tell you a little story. I'm sorry, it is not exactly a pleasant story. It is indeed rather gruesome. Or rather, we would have considered it rather gruesome in the days before good Uncle Stalin in the dear old Kremlin started to tell us his kind of bedtime stories. But I can hardly hope to compete with that experienced raconteur, who is the world's greatest expert at ending every one of his nice little fables with a loud bang, just one loud bang, and then the man to whom he has told his little story invariably has laughed himself to death. All the same, what I'm about to tell you is interesting, for it is something that actually happened. And it happened in France during the busy season of the Reign of Terror. Of course, you have every right to expect something unusual. For the Reign of Terror in France was exactly like the period in which we ourselves live today. The unusual had so completely become the usual that nobody was any longer surprised at anything. Hence, there is no use to ask ourselves, could such things actually happen? Such things not only could happen, but they happened every morning and evening of every day. Until the people had learned to accept them as a part of a universe that somehow had gone out of gear and in which all the laws of logic had been temporarily suspended, as they are once more right now. And therefore, although the story I'm about to tell you sounds absolutely preposterous and impossible, it was such a commonplace occurrence at that moment that soon afterwards it was forgotten. But careful researches in the archives have brought it back to life, and I can now even give you the name of the chief actor in this episode and the prison in which it took place. The prison was the Conciergerie, which is now part of the well-known Palace of Justice, the same prison in which Marie Antoinette was locked up in that horrible dungeon, as well as afterwards Danton and most of her judges, for that is the way it goes in a revolution. Now it was during one of those weeks when the Reign of Terror was working under forced draft. By the way, in that respect too, Comrade Stalin has a lot to learn. He dispatches his enemies only by batches of 2 or 3 dozen and then once every 4 or 5 or 6 months. The Reign of Terror would have felt a deep contempt for such amateurish methods. We still have all the lists of their victims. On days when these charming gentlemen who made up the tribunal, when they had lunched well and felt in a really genial mood, they would hack off 50 or 60 or sometimes even 70 heads. The trials, if you wish to call them so, we call almost anything nowadays a trial, they took only a few minutes, for you had confessed your guilt by the mere fact of having fallen into the hands of the secret police. Now, on this particular day, when the terror was working under forced draft, the number of the elect for the guillotine was 45. These poor devils were ready to be taken to the scaffold. Their hair had been cut and their collars had been removed. They were transported in heavy wooden carts from the Conciergerie to the Place de Grève, where the guillotine happened to stand then. The Place de Grève was the old place of execution, opposite the town hall, and so quite naturally the spot where the first of the revolutionary executions took place. For then, these were still very popular. You must remember, the enemy was at the gate of France, And it was only right that the aristocrats, the traitors who had called in these foreign powers that were threatening France, that they should suffer the consequences of their treason. Now, afterwards, when the executions degenerated into mere mass murder, the populace began to show signs of irritation. And it was only then that the guillotine was moved further away from the center of the city to what is now called the Place de la Concorde. You must have seen it, opposite the office of the Guaranteed Trust, where you go to call for your mail in the morning and to see how much they'll give you for your American dollars. But when the story I am about to tell you took place, the guillotine still stood on the Place de Grève, and every morning the heavy carts would slowly rumble down the narrow streets that ran from the prison to the place of execution. It was a matter of routine, rather dull routine, but on that particular morning somebody had apparently slipped up on the arrangements, for there were four carts but 45 prisoners. Now, those carts were so built that they would hold exactly 11 prisoners each, and one driver makes 12 people in all. The job of driving the prisoners to their doom was done by regular contractors, regular hack drivers, and the drivers were paid a flat sum for their 11 prisoners per day. Well, you see what's going to happen. They loaded their prisoners, 11 to a cart, 4 times 11, which even in revolutionary days made 44. But then it was discovered that there was one prisoner left. And then there arose one of those strange French squabbles which you still may notice at any railroad station or any place with a streetcar stop, for the French are very particular about details which involve money. Well, here it was. The keeper of the jail said, "Hey, there's another one left. Take him." And the drivers of the cart surly answered, "We are being paid for 11 prisoners per trip. The contract says nothing about 12. We get paid for 11 prisoners per cart and not for 12. So you keep the extra care and we won't take him." Well, the jailkeeper replied that having checked his prisoner out, he had no longer anything to do with him. To take care of him for one other night meant extra expense for board and lodging, and more than likely he would never get his 2 francs. He didn't intend to lose any money out of his own pocket, because somebody at the tribunal had got his figures mixed. So would they please take the odd man and be gone? The drivers of the carts were equally adamant. They most decidedly would not. Their contract called for 11 prisoners per cart, and the jailkeeper could keep his prisoner or throw him in the river or in the lake all the same. They didn't care. It was none of their business. It was their business to take 11 prisoners, and they made those strange noises which French car drivers invariably make when they want their horses to get into motion, and off they rumbled out of the prison gate, bound for the scaffold. Whereupon the jailkeeper pushed his extra prisoner outside and locked the gates of the jail. For the prisoner was no longer any concern of his, and that was that. But now mark what happens next, for that is really the interesting part of the story. The rest is commonplace enough. The prisoner, like all the others, had his hand bound behind his back, but for the rest he was free to go. Of course, he was entirely surrounded by a large number of Parisian citizens and citizenesses who had brought the little ones to teach them applied democracy by showing them the enemies of the Republic hastening to their just reward, a happy scene, family party. But not a single hand was raised to set the poor prisoner free, for that again, that might have got them into trouble with the secret police, and besides, it was none of their business. And a Frenchman does not like to interfere with other people's business. But neither was it their duty to drag this young man to the guillotine, for that was up to the police. And now I ask you, what do you think this young man did, whose name, by the way, was Gostin, G-O-S-S-I-N, Monsieur Gostin? He could have run away in the hope that he would find the blacksmith willing to relieve him of his chains, whereupon he might then have hidden himself or could have found some way to escape from Paris. To you and me, that would have seemed an entirely normal thing to do. But if he had done so, then there wouldn't have been any story to tell and no moral to draw from this story. Suddenly, young Gostin had an inspiration. The carts had already turned the corner of the street, but he could still catch up with them if he ran fast enough. And so, believe it or not, with his hands still tied behind his back, the prisoner ran after the carts until he had joined up with them. Then he followed them, a little out of breath, all the way to the scaffold, and he had his head chopped off. Now, impossible, you would say. Couldn't be that way. But I give you my word that is exactly what happened. Out of his own free will, young Gossin followed the 44 other prisoners to their doom and had his head hacked off. Now, why I'm telling you this story, not because I want to add still another bit of horror to one of the most horrible days through which I've ever lived, the days of the endless Austrian suicides. I'm telling you this, my good friends, because that young man today has millions of followers. I would almost say hundreds of millions. That young man was a victim that morning, not of the reign of terror, but of his own warped mentality. He could have been free, he was free. But his mind, like that of most of the other Frenchmen of that period, had been so warped, had been so crushed by years and years of injustice and cruelty and violence that it no longer functioned in a normal way. His willpower had been paralyzed by the terror that had overtaken the world at large. Now, as you well know, I'm no psychologist, but all through history we have examples of just such developments. We are, after all, what our minds make us, and our minds can be made to function in almost any way if clever psychologists are given a chance to influence them according to their own plans and ideas. And as we have just once more seen in Russia during the last few weeks, such clever psychologists can gradually prepare the human mind to accept the prospect of death and destruction just as cheerfully and just as willingly and patiently as normal people under normal circumstances will accept the chances of life and happiness. However, let's leave Russia out of the discussion. The mind of Asia has never quite functioned like the mind of Europe, so that's no fair example. Let us rather consider our own case, for these are days when clear thinking and a clear understanding of ourselves and the world around us may decide our own immediate future. Yes, may well decide our very chance to survive. For the last 4 days, we have been wondering why nobody in Europe moves a finger, while the armies of Hitler march into another country and annex it with less ceremony than if it had been Ethiopia. We have sat by in silent horror while treaties were torn up. Well, what does that matter? When every rule of decency was being trampled underfoot by the goose-stepping followers of the now divinely inspired Führer. Well, think a moment. Now, doesn't that sad and absurd story of poor Monsieur Gossin give you a key to this riddle? Haven't the people of Europe been submitted to the same process of violence and fury for such a long time that their power of free will, too, has gradually become paralyzed, that their feeling of independence has been so completely lamed that they are ready to accept their doom without a word of protest, just like poor young Gossin? We ourselves, protected by 4,000 miles of ocean, pursuing our own peaceful ways, are still able to do so. We have as yet not felt that deadening touch of paralysis of the will that lames all the efforts of the free nations of Europe, and may that day never come. For it would be the end of the last hope of our sorely stricken world, so do whatever you like, but don't be a Gossin. You'll be dead long enough without asking for it.
And with this, his very interesting, illustrative story of the present political situation in Europe, the well-known author and philosopher, Hendrik Willem van Loon, bids you all good night. This is the National Broadcasting Company, the RCA Building in Radio City.